KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. NPR is suing the Trump administration. The network's CEO says attacks against public media threaten the First Amendment. We hear from the lawyer taking the White House to court on Morning Edition from NPR News. The Trump administration says nobody died because of cuts to USAID. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A family in Nigeria begs to differ. The family and a doctor tell NPR a clinic that closed would have saved a boy's life. Also, what do you learn when you photograph people and return for more pictures a quarter century later? It's Wednesday, May 28th. This day in 1972, burglars working on behalf of President Nixon broke into Democratic Party offices in the Watergate complex. A later break-in was foiled, leading to Nixon's downfall. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Hamas leader Mohammed Sinwar has been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Netanyahu did not say where he was killed. Mohammed Sinwar is the younger brother of Yahya Sinwar, who Israel says planned the October 7, 2023 attacks on southern Israel. Yahya Sinwar was killed last fall, and his younger brother Mohammed became a senior Hamas commander in Gaza. Meanwhile, Israel says its air force has struck the main airport in the capital of Yemen. That's after Iranian-backed Houthi forces, who control much of Yemen, have repeatedly fired missiles at Israel in recent weeks. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv, Israel blames Iran.
Israel's defense minister says Israeli fighter jets have struck the Sana'a airport and destroyed the last remaining airplane in use by the Houthi rebels. In recent weeks, the Houthis have fired missiles towards central Israel, saying they're aiming at Israel's international airport to protest Israel's assault in Gaza. A Houthi missile hit near the Tel Aviv airport this month, and many airlines continue to suspend flights. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Iran is responsible. The show of force, with Israeli warplanes reaching as far as Yemen, could serve as a message to Iran. The New York Times reports Netanyahu has threatened to strike Iranian nuclear sites and upend U.S. talks with Iran. Netanyahu called the report fake news. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The State Department is planning to do a more thorough screening of the social media posts of international students who want to come to the U.S. That's according to a diplomatic cable NPR has seen. It calls for extra vigilance in the student visa process. The change means this could make it harder for international students to make appointments at consulates around the world to apply for U.S. visas. The Senate is reviewing the multi-trillion-dollar government spending bill that cuts taxes and social services. The nonprofit Congressional Budget Office estimates millions of people will lose health care coverage under Medicaid. Noam Levy tells us feelings are complicated about this in one Arizona county.
Like a lot of rural places around America, Gila County, Arizona has become increasingly dependent in recent years on government health insurance like Medicaid. But many people in this copper mining center in the mountains east of Phoenix also say there's plenty of waste that should be trimmed. Debbie Cox works at a property management company. She has tenants who rely on Medicaid, she says.
It's not that I don't see the need for it. I see the need for it literally on a weekly basis. But I also see a need for revamping it significantly because it's been taken advantage of for so long.
How many people are actually taking advantage of Medicaid and how much waste there is are hotly debated. That debate will be front and center as the Senate prepares to take up the House GOP plan.
That's Noam Levy with our partner KFF Health News. On Wall Street, the Dow is lower. It's down by about 81 points. You're listening to NPR. The West African nation of Namibia is marking its first Genocide Remembrance Day today with a candlelight vigil in front of Parliament. Kate Bartlett reports the new public holiday commemorates a genocide of indigenous people by German colonizers.
German colonizers killed more than 70,000 people from the Herero and Nama communities between 1904 and 1908. At the time, Namibia was called Southwest Africa and was under German occupation. The extermination campaign started after those communities fought back against German rule. Many were sent to concentration camps where they were subjected to hard labor and died from exhaustion and starvation. In 2021, Germany acknowledged committing genocide in Namibia and announced $1.3 billion in financial aid for the country. However, many activists rejected this because it failed to include a formal apology and reparations. Negotiations are ongoing. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
The private company SpaceX launched its ninth Starship rocket yesterday. The massive rocket blasted off well from southern Texas, but it later broke apart. Officials say it may have been lost high over the Indian Ocean. A group of climate scientists is going to launch a 100-hour live stream event today. The group says the event is nonpartisan. It's going to highlight the value that climate science brings to Americans and people worldwide. This live stream will last through Sunday, June 1st. That is also the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, how do Iran's indirect negotiations with the United States look from Iran's capital, Tehran?
First, though, NPR CEO and President Catherine Marr said the network is suing the Trump administration over an executive order that tries to stop any federal funds from going to NPR or PBS. But she said it is a response to a bigger threat than the president's efforts to cut the funding. Here's Marr on All Things Considered yesterday.
We are not choosing to do this out of politics. We are choosing to do this as a matter of necessity and principle. All of our rights that we enjoy in this democracy flow from the First Amendment, freedom of speech, association, freedom of the press. When we see those rights infringed upon, we have an obligation to challenge them, and that's what's at stake here.
NPR and three of its member stations in Colorado filed the lawsuit. Marr said the three stations represent the diversity of the network. Theodore Boutros is a veteran of numerous First Amendment cases, and he represents NPR in the lawsuit, and he's on the line with us now from Los Angeles. Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Good to be with you.
I do want to mention that no one from management had any involvement with the conversation we're about to have. So the brief makes a First Amendment argument as well as a separation of powers argument. So let's take those separately. First, what is the First Amendment issue here?
The First Amendment issue here, Michelle, is that the Public Broadcasting Act created an elaborate structure to insulate private media entities, local stations, NPR, from government interference on content. And this executive order from President Trump explicitly, over and over again, says that it's being issued because President Trump and others in his administration do not like the content. They think it's biased. We obviously disagree with that, but that's the classic example of viewpoint discrimination by the government and retaliation by the government for speech on matters of public concern. That's about as blatant First Amendment violation as you can have, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly condemned that and said that news organizations and people have a right to make editorial decisions on their own without government interference.
The legal brief says it's not always obvious when the government acts with a, quote, retaliatory purpose, unquote, in violation of the First Amendment. But the brief goes on to say, quote, this wolf comes as a wolf. And those are words that the late Justice Antonin Scalia used in a different case. Say more about why you say it's obvious that this is retaliation.
It's so obvious, and usually government will sort of try to hide what it's doing. If it's trying to censor, it will say we're doing it for some other purpose. But here, the executive order and statements by the administration before and after the executive order say things like NPR is woke, NPR is biased, it's the arm of a political party. All of that is false. They just don't like the content, which is fine. The government officials, everyone has the right to say, I don't like this content. I'm going to read something or listen to something else. But here, on its face, explicitly, the executive order is a wolf. It's a censoring mechanism meant to control and interfere with NPR's content and the local stations who subscribe to and license NPR content, who would be barred from doing that by this denial of funding by the executive order if it were to go into effect.
The lawsuit also says the administration is usurping the power of Congress to direct how federal funds are spent, as well as the expressed will of Congress that public media's independence be protected. Now, the White House has said in response to NPR that the president is exercising his mandate to ensure efficient use of taxpayer dollars. And the White House says through a spokesperson that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is creating media to support a particular political party on taxpayers' dime. And as you've, you know, pointed out, President Trump and his allies have publicly called public broadcasters left-wing sort of propaganda. How do you sort that out? How do you respond to that? I mean, the president said that that is his job.
That's just wrong. In fact, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, which is an amazing statute, really, where Congress created what the Supreme Court has called an elaborate structure that both funds public media via the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but then creates this structure meant to bar the president and bar Congress and bar the government from doing exactly what this executive order does, which is to try to invoke power to control the content. And the statute itself explicitly says the government cannot interfere, cannot control content or any of the operations involved here. And one of my favorite quotes from the Supreme Court from the FCC v. League of Women Voters case is, because local stations are the bedrock of the system, their independence from government interference and control must be fully guaranteed. The president is overstepping that explicit restriction on his authority.
So let me ask you two more questions here. Let me just ask, for the sake of argument, let's just say that there are people who agree with the president. They don't like NPR. They don't like the content. What argument do you have for them for why this lawsuit should prevail?
That's really the beauty of the First Amendment. It's not a partisan tool. If people don't like NPR, then they can listen to something else. They can get their information from some other source. But if the president of the United States, this one or someone in the future, has the power to control content of NPR or the local stations, then they can do it to anyone. And that means your content is going to be fettered and interfered with. And that's terrible. And the purpose of the First Amendment is to allow the American people to get the information they need to govern themselves.
30 seconds left. But what do you say to those who argue that the First Amendment doesn't guarantee the right to federal funds?
And that's not what we're arguing. Congress has appropriated those funds. And by getting those funds to the entities that broadcast, those entities are then allowed to engage in freedom of speech. It's not about guaranteeing funds. It's the government interfering with content.
That is attorney Theodore Boutros. He's a partner in the Los Angeles office of Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher. He's representing NPR in its First Amendment lawsuit against the Trump administration. Mr. Boutros, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Indirect talks between the United States and Iran over a potential new nuclear deal have resumed. President Trump said there could be, quote, good news soon, but negotiators on both sides have drawn hard lines. To understand Iran's perspective on negotiating with the Trump administration, we reached out to Saeed Mohammed Mirandi, a political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran. Mirandi insists the sticking point of uranium enrichment is an issue of Iranian sovereignty.
Iran knows that the United States uses sanctions as a weapon. And so Iran is not going to build reactors without having the ability to provide those reactors with homemade fuel. In fact, in the past, during a period when Iran had a shortage of gasoline, the United States attempted to block the import of gasoline itself. So when the United States behaves in such a manner, obviously Iran is going to be very careful about energy security, which includes nuclear energy.
Now, President Trump has said that there's reason for optimism in these talks, but from Iran's perspective, I mean, is there any sense that progress is actually being made?
It's unclear what Trump means, because he says different things on different days. So we can't take anything seriously. The only thing that matters for Iran is what happens at the negotiating table. Iran will not be intimidated by threats. The driving force for the Iranian negotiators is the preservation of Iranian sovereignty and not to allow Iran to become vulnerable to U.S. sanctions. Beyond that, everything else is solvable. But the problem is that inside the United States, you have the neocons and the Zionist lobby, which have their own priorities, and their priority is Israel first. And that could have a huge impact on the way in which the negotiations move forward.
So given that President Trump withdrew from the original nuclear deal back in 2018, what level of trust does Iran have in the United States as a negotiating partner now?
The Iranians never trusted the United States. We've had many deals with Americans, which every single one of them was broken in the past. Every single one. In the 1980s, in the 1990s, and over the last 20-some years since the so-called war on terror began. Trump has been no different from previous leaders in the United States, but he did tear up a deal. And that makes it all the more difficult for Iran to negotiate a new deal, because we don't know if, even hypothetically, if a deal is signed, how do we know that the following morning we won't see something on Truth Social opposed by Trump rejecting the deal?
There have also been warnings from Israel that it might launch attacks against Iranian nuclear facilities if these talks break down. How seriously does Iran think those threats are?
Well, the Israeli regime can't carry out an attack on Iran without U.S. assistance. The last time they did it, the United States was there for them. They used their radar facilities across the Persian Gulf and in Turkey. If, though, the Israeli regime attacks, Iran has already stated that they will change their nuclear posture. It won't end well for the Israeli regime either, because Iran will strike back very hard. And I think they know it. But the problem is that Netanyahu is fighting for his own personal survival. He's not fighting for the interests of the regime itself. Therefore, if that undermines the regime but preserves his power, I think that's fine with him.
I mean, as much as President Trump seems to be enthusiastic right now, it seems like a deal is still very, very far away.
A deal could be at hand. It could be quite close. That would depend on Trump. If Trump recognizes and accepts Iran's sovereignty, then we could have a deal. It wouldn't be very difficult, actually. But if Trump wants to impose something on Iran that infringes the country's sovereignty, there's not a chance in the world that that will happen. Iran is probably the most fiercely independent country in the world. The revolution, to a huge degree, was about dignity and sovereignty. And that is not something that the Iranians will surrender.
That is Professor Saeed Mohammad Mirandi, a political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is NPR News.
of the next fresh air, how J.D. Vance rose from a struggling Ohio steel town to Yale Law School, venture capital, and now the vice presidency. Along the way, he shed old convictions and adopted new ones, some deeply divisive. We'll speak with George Packer about his Atlantic Magazine article on Vance's transformation and what it reveals about the future of American politics. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Nearly 10% of people in the United States are of mixed race. That's according to the latest census. That is a 276% increase from just a decade before. In the Hawaiian language, there's a word for people who are mixed: hapa.
Basically, hapa means half or portion.
That is photographer Kip Fulbeck. He's hapa himself, half Chinese and half white.
It's a transliteration of the English word half. There's no sound of F in Hawaiian language, so it's the pronunciation of half. And it was originally used to describe offspring of people that were from white settlers and indigenous Hawaiians, Kanaka Maoli.
Fulbeck spent the last 25 years working on the Hapa Project, a series of portraits of people who identify as multiracial. Each photo is accompanied by the subject's handwritten answer to a question about their identity. Now, the first iteration of the project in 2001 featured photos from some 1,200 people. Now, the series is back, with Fulbeck revisiting some of the original participants to see how their thoughts about being mixed race have changed over time. Fulbeck says this project was born out of his own Hapa identity and never knowing which box to check.
It was tough being an Asian kid where I grew up, and so I would check white sometimes, but then I was obviously not passing for white, and so I would check one, check the other. Sometimes they would have this other box that said, other, please explain, and I would just write no. And it wasn't until, like, I think it was 2000 where the U.S. Census actually allowed people to check more than one box. So, you know, for 35 years of my life, I wasn't able to even legally do that for my own, in my own country.
Now, when you started to conceive of the project, the Hapa Project, what were you hoping at first that it would look like, that it would be like?
I was heavily influenced by two artists. One, Jim Goldberg, who was this great photographer in San Francisco. He does work on people and they write their handwriting. And I saw his work on people in nursing homes, and it just stuck with me how important the written word was. And then Linda Berry, the great comic artist, who was just so honest in her work, exploring her own identity as a Filipino American. And so I thought I would just do this project, and I never really wanted to get off the ground because with my crazy ADD, I thought I can never organize this. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and I told her the project, and she's like, this is a great idea. And I'm like, it's too much trouble. And she's like, if you don't do it, someone else is going to do it, and you're going to hate how they do it. You're going to be so angry. I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I started to do it, and I was really amazed that, you know, I'd make an announcement, and there's 30 people at the door waiting to get photographed. And the way that people came in and really just jumped into this project really astounded me. I was surprised.
Now, when you look at these portraits, they're essentially the same, taken from the shoulders up. Fulbeck says he did this on purpose. He wanted everyone to be photographed the same way without any external identifiers.
Meaning no clothing, no jewelry, no glasses, no, you know, no purposeful expression. It's just collarbone up. You know, we carry driver's licenses and ID cards and, you know, passports, gym memberships. And we use this to define ourselves, to say, I really am who I am. We have to do that all the time. Prove who you are. And so I wanted to take that and kind of flip it and let people, you know, have their own pictures. And I have them handwrite a response to the question, what are you? And I don't ever censor what they write.
So I'll just say the thing that the person in the first picture that you see when you go to the website says, I am a challenge for the simple mind to try and make sense of labels, prejudice, and stereotypes. And then the update is, I am a person of color. I am not half white. I am not half Asian. I am a whole other. So it is a true evolution of maybe how they feel about themselves, how they feel about the way the world sees them.
Yeah, it's. I think that's accurate. Identity is internal, but it's also this external way that we relate with others. And so I think as we become more comfortable in our skin and our place in the world and where we fit in, and that depends where you're living too. If I'm living in Santa Barbara, it's very different from when I'm living in Hawaii.
Yeah, and so this project is now a quarter of a century in. I mean, you clearly, I think, kept up with some of these people. Have their perspective changed in that time being part of this?
Oh, absolutely. I've never had a problem with people wanting to come back to it. And you see like physical changes on them, obviously, but you also see these changes in attitude as we sort of mature and we grow and we change as adults. And I remember I photographed one woman, Teresa, and she was like, I think 22 and then around 38. And I looked at the photos together. I made a diptych and I said, Teresa, how do you look better and younger, you know, 18 years later? And she goes, oh, 20s were hard, man. 20s sucked.
Yeah. Now, so one thing we noticed looking at your project over time is that the word Hapa is being reclaimed or reinterpreted. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that language is always a constant evolution. It evolves, it changes. I've had people say, well, Hapa means this, or no, Hapa means this. You know, it means only people that are part Hawaiian. It means only people that are part Japanese. And to me, it's like, it's not our place to tell someone else who they are. You're the only person who gets to define who you are. You get to say that, because if you don't say who you are and define it correctly, other people are going to do it for you, and they're going to do it wrong.
Yeah. The United States, there's plenty of people in the United States that are intermarrying more and more, and it's been going on for decades. What's your advice to parents raising Hapa kids, and even grandparents? Because I'll admit to you, Kip, my granddaughters are half Japanese, and they are very much aware of that side of their identity. But they also, you know, I'm trying my best to try and help them too. I enroll them in Japanese language classes so that they can kind of keep track of that part of their life and their culture. But what's your advice to parents who are raising Hapa kids?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question. As a parent myself, I sort of ask myself this all the time. People have asked, like, you know, do you talk to your kids about being Hapa? And I was like, I don't. I said, why? I go, because they're dealing with dad doing this all over the world. It's like, they don't want to hear about this. My kids, they want to play Fortnite. You know, they just want to be kids. So I always just tell parents, you just got to love your kids, be open to them. When they want to explore it, then be willing to do it. But you can't sit there and force it. Like, I got forced to go to Chinese school and I hated it. But then later, when I was older and I joined the Chinese Cultural Association and I, you know, the Nikkei Student Union and these things that I was, you know, involved with, or, you know, first time living in Hawaii, it was just like these eye-opening experiences. So I just say, be open to it.
That's Kip Fulbeck, the photographer behind the Hapa Project, which explores the unique cultural identities of half Asian and half Pacific Islander people. The project relaunched on May 23rd at the Museum of Us in San Diego. Kip, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Jay.
This is NPR News.
A Minnesota couple was shocked to learn that their son had joined a terrorist organization. Then they discovered they had grandkids trapped in a detention camp in Syria. Getting them home took years.
They certainly were scared. I think they were also just confused. They'd been on 20-some hours of flights.
I'm Elsa Chang. What happened to the children of the Americans who fought for ISIS, one of the most violent jihadist groups in the world? That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Trump administration is tightening vetting of international students. An official who spoke on condition of anonymity says the State Department's freezing new visa interviews for international students until it sets up a new process for screening applicants' social media activity. Harvard University is defying the Trump administration's actions that critics say are targeting constitutionally protected rights to express political dissent. So Harvard students rallied. The former president of the Harvard Hillel organization, Jacob Miller, accuses President Trump of using claims of anti-Semitism to justify his actions.
These policies will do nothing to combat this age-old hatred. Instead, they are designed to divide us apart.
Last week, the administration revoked Harvard's ability to enroll international students. The school sued and won a court battle to temporarily block Trump's efforts. The state of the planet is getting worse. Liz Bentley, head of the UK's Royal Meteorological Society, contributed to a global climate report.
We're getting more frequent and intense heat waves, more extreme rainfall events, more devastating droughts. Our oceans are warming, sea ice and land ice are melting, and sea levels are rising. So we will see all of those being exacerbated as the global temperatures continue to rise.
Liz Bentley on the BBC. From Washington, this is NPR News. Against the backdrop of political strife in Bangladesh, a mob torched more than a dozen homes in a minority Hindu community. NPR's Omkar Khandekar has more on last week's attack.
Vandals burned down 19 houses and destroyed Hindu religious idols after a politician from one of Bangladesh's biggest political parties was found dead in southwestern Bangladesh. A senior police officer told NPR that the politician was from the Islamist-leaning BNP party. His dead body was found at the residence of a Hindu man in Dohor Moshihati village, where he had gone to sort out a real estate dispute. The officer said this led to retaliatory attacks where a mob burned down houses of Hindus living in the neighborhood. Bangladesh has seen a spike in attacks on minority communities in the months after nationwide student protests prompted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to flee the country. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
A global team of astronomers says it has detected a new object located about 150,000 light years away in our Milky Way galaxy. The scientists say it could be a star, maybe a pair of stars, or perhaps something else entirely, emitting X-rays around the same time it's shooting out radio waves in a cycle that they say repeats every 44 minutes. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump, with the help of Elon Musk, cut billions of dollars in global health programs earlier this year. The administration has dismissed the idea that that had much effect. Here's an exchange between Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Democratic Representative Brad Sherman of California during a hearing last week.
Has anyone in the world died because of what Elon Musk did?
Listen,
yes or no, reclaiming my time. If you won't answer, that's a loud answer.
No one has died because of USAID.
The people who have died as a result.
That was the assertion. Nobody died because of the cuts to USAID. So we checked it out. which is a thing we do at NPR. People say stuff. We let you know and then check the facts. Is it true? NPR Global Health correspondent Gabriella Emanuel is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
How do you go about checking if that statement is true, that nobody died?
So I spoke to a lot of people in a variety of different countries, and the answer is yes, people have died as a result of aid cuts. So let me tell you about one family. They live in a town in northeastern Nigeria, and the mother's name is Mariam Mohammed. She told me that her younger son was 7 years old. He had a bike he loved, and he had sickle cell disease. She took him to a local clinic for his medical care. Then, this past February, she noticed one night that her son had a fever. Early in the morning, she rushed him to the clinic. Speaking in Kanuri, she said when they got there, the security guard said the clinic was closed. That clinic had been funded by USAID and had received a stop work order about a week earlier. I was shocked and became angry, says Mariam Mohammed, who is a widow. She didn't have money to pay for treatment at the government clinic. She says she prayed for God to intervene. Her son died that night. His name was Babagana. Edifre Jacob is a doctor at the clinic. He cared for Babagana before the stop work order. He says patients with sickle cell disease, where the red blood cells are misshapen, can deteriorate very quickly, but prompt medical care can save their lives.
We are sure we would have done something to save the patient.
Now, this particular U.S.-funded clinic did reopen in mid-April, but many others like it are still closed.
Wow, there's a lot of details we could talk about there, one of them being she couldn't afford to pay for health care from her own government, but was getting help from the United States at one time. With that said, how certain are you that this death was the result of U.S. aid cuts?
Well, he didn't get medical help that day, so we don't actually know exactly what was making him sick. But his doctor says they take care of a lot of patients with sickle cell, including the boy's brother, and with good results. Other experts I spoke with said there are several serious conditions the boy could have had. One is sepsis, life-threatening infection. That's not uncommon for people with sickle cell, but with antibiotics, it's curable if the clinic had been open to provide treatment.
Is there evidence of other deaths linked to aid cuts?
Well, it is very hard to pin down precise numbers. In many places, including where this family is from, there isn't a formal system for death certificates. The U.S. had funded efforts to gather this type of data, but aid cuts have disrupted much of that. Now, there are researchers who are trying to get to the bottom of this.
Okay, what are they finding?
Well, modeling out of Boston University estimates that the abrupt cuts to USAID have meant nearly 300,000 people have died to date. These are really rough estimates, but they give a sense of scale. Researchers are talking many thousands of deaths, not dozens. The State Department did not respond to requests for comment, but in front of Congress, Marco Rubio pushed back, saying these models are completely inaccurate and maintained that nobody, especially no child, has died on his watch.
NPR's Gabriella Emanuel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
People on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming have lost a revered elder. Marion Scott was one of fewer than 100 fluent speakers of the Arapaho language. She died last month. Scott spent her life preserving her tribe's language and culture as an elementary school teacher and a mainstay at powwows, community events, and basketball games. Here's her colleague, Patricia Goggles.
Everybody called her Nawa, which is grandma, which is my grandma, you know, when you're talking to your personal grandma.
Elena Singer directs the Language and Culture Department at Wyoming Indian Schools. She and her colleagues remember Marion Scott in this story from Wyoming Public Radio.
She made our school a place where kids felt like they belonged because they had an AWOL, her grandma. Kids would go to her for a hug. They could see her in the hallway. And just seeing her in the hallway brought comfort to a lot of our students, you know, because she was a loving person. We have monthly translation meetings where we invite them in and they work with our teachers it's just wonderful to hear them when they get together and they talk, and they're talking in Arapaho and they're laughing, and it's a beautiful sound, and we're all listening with our whole beings, trying to hang on to every word that they're saying so we can keep it going.
I'm Ray Youngchi, and when I became a teacher, it was real surprising because a couple weeks after I started in on my job, she seen me and she said, "Hey, how come you didn't tell me you were teaching?" And I said, "Oh yeah, I am." She said, "I know. My grandkids come home and tell me what you teach." She said, "You're good." You know, that really made me feel good about myself, because coming from a teacher like her, you know, that says a lot.
My name is Patricia Goggles. I have known her for being a fluent speaker, for being a mom, a grandmother, and just somebody that our community could depend on. She was very powerful presence, and she will be missed. I'm sorry, I can't hardly talk about her without, kind of left a big, great big blow to our language. And I guess one of the best things that we can do to honor her memory is to encourage our young people to learn our language. The work that she has done with her life is really, really important. And if we can do half of what she's done to impact our community, we would be in a good place, you know. She impacted so many lives. It's going to be felt for a really long time.
That was Patricia Goggles, Ray Youngchief, and Elena Singer, voices gathered by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman. This is NPR News.
Want to be free from distraction, the pressure of your daily to-do list? There are ways to escape. One musician found it with improvisation. Her story, next time in Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them. In your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. When you're not feeling well, you see a doctor. Some people struggle with that simple advice, but a monkey could do it. In India, the monkey walked into a veterinarian's clinic with an injury on his rear end. He got the attention of a vet and pointed to his wound and got medicine. The monkey then left. So to review, a monkey knows to ask for help. But how did he do with filling out the appeal when the insurance company rejected his claim? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are going next to Libby, Montana. The Census Bureau marks its population at 2,775. The nearest big city is hundreds of miles away. So it is the kind of American place that you can mainly learn about on NPR. People in Libby spent about 70 years mining vermiculite, a mineral used in everything from home insulation to garden soil. Most of the world's supply came from that one town. The town later learned that vermiculite was contaminated with asbestos. Thousands of people would get lung cancer and other diseases. Now, a lawsuit has shut down a clinic set up to help them. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
Gayla Benefield lives just outside of Libby along the picturesque Kootenai River, surrounded by snow-capped peaks.
Hey. Nice to meet you.
Okay, you just wait here, Jim. We'll be right back.
Inside her home, the 81-year-old is tethered to an oxygen machine with dozens of feet of tubing so she can walk from room to room. Like many here, Benefield's lungs are scarred by asbestos.
That scarring will totally surround your lungs and slowly strangle you.
Benefield's father was a vermiculite miner. Dust on his work clothes exposed his family to asbestos. Everyone thought vermiculite was harmless. It was even used in the dirt at local baseball fields.
I would take my younger kids down, and they would play in the piles outside the fields, the piles of vermiculite. Every child that went down there probably has been exposed.
The mine closed in 1990. A decade later, a special clinic funded by the federal government would open to diagnose and treat victims of what the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency would declare a public health emergency. This spring, that clinic, the Center for Asbestos-Related Disease, or CARD, was still helping Benefield's family.
4 out of 5 of my children have been diagnosed. My oldest daughter with the heaviest exposure has got to go in for a CT tomorrow.
But this month, a lawsuit shut the clinic down. It was filed by BNSF Railway a couple of years ago using a whistleblower law designed to stop Medicare fraud. The railroad said the clinic was erroneously diagnosing people with asbestos-related diseases and billing Medicare for treatment. Why would the railroad care?
So in this case, obviously, the railroad felt that the CARD clinic was harming its business because it had been found strictly liable for environmental asbestos claims in and around the town of Libby.
Tim Bechtold represented the clinic in the lawsuit. Courts have said BNSF is liable for spreading asbestos. Its trains hauled vermiculite away from the mine. In a statement to NPR, BNSF denied its lawsuit is an attempt to avoid liability for people suffering from poisoned vermiculite. The clinic is appealing the court settlement that forced it to close. It denies it was defrauding the government. And now, federal prosecutors have also stepped in to help defend CARD. In the meantime, patients will have to look elsewhere for care.
There's going to be probably a lot of people just lost out there with no place to go.
Janann Swenson is Gayla Benefield's only child without an asbestos-related disease. For now, the 62-year-old is in the clear, but she'll need screenings for the rest of her life because diseases tied to asbestos have such a long latency period.
There's no way I could even swing getting this done out of my own pocket if I didn't, have the CARD clinic.
Swenson fully expects to eventually develop breathing problems from her asbestos exposure as a child. She's crossing her fingers the clinic here will reopen in time. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Libby, Montana.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The biggest opposition party in Germany is the Nationalist Anti-Immigration Alternative for Germany Party. It's a party that's been labeled as extremist by the country's domestic intelligence agency. The agency is now allowed to tap party members' phones and hire informants to monitor them to ensure they're not a threat to Germany's democracy. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio have criticized the move, calling it, quote, tyranny in disguise. But it is allowed under the German Constitution, a constitution that the United States helped shape. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
September 1946, President Harry Truman, Secretary of State James Burns takes the podium in Stuttgart, a city ravaged by war and occupied by U.S. forces.
We do not want Germany to become the satellite of any power or powers, or to live under a dictatorship, foreign or domestic.
This was later called the Speech of Hope, and in it, Burns signaled to his German counterparts that the U.S. was expecting them to draft a constitution that would rigorously protect democracy, human rights, and individual freedoms.
The American people hope to see a peaceful and democratic Germany become and remain free and independent. The American people want to return the government of Germany to the people of Germany.
But the American people had strict terms.
One point was non-negotiable, and that was that the new German constitution would be a strongly federalist regime.
Russell Miller is a law professor at Washington and Lee University, an author of Constitutional Places about the history of Germany's constitution. He says the U.S. insisted Germany become a federal state, one where power was decentralized.
So it has that significant advantage of splitting government authority, splitting state power, so that no single entity, no single actor can utilize all of state power at any one time.
Miller says U.S. General Lucius Clay, who administered occupied post-war Germany, wanted to prevent the return of a dictator like Adolf Hitler.
And we're going to constitutionalize and entrench in the Constitution the tools we need to prevent that from happening again. And one of the distinct elements of this new post-war constitution is a thing the Germans refer to as militant democracy.
This means a democracy that fights any power that would threaten it.
There's code built into the constitution that allows the German state to act in illiberal ways in order to protect liberalism and constitutionalism, to protect democracy.
This somewhat paradoxical illiberal power is wielded by Germany's Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, known in German as the Verfassungsschutz. Earlier this month, the office labeled the Alternative for Germany party extremist, giving the office special powers to surveil the party, which holds 151 seats in Germany's parliament.
But it is a domestic intelligence service. That's what it does, and it provides intelligence for the government about extremists.
Maximilian Steinbeiß is founder of the Verfassungsblog, a Berlin-based forum for constitutional law. Steinbeiß says that while embedding a domestic intelligence service into the government to protect Germany's democracy may have looked good on paper, in practice, it's been clumsy and at times ineffective. The agency in charge of domestic intelligence has, at times in recent history, itself been infiltrated by extremists. Steinbeiß says it's risky to believe the powers enshrined in the Constitution will protect the Constitution. Only the level of people's respect and education of their Constitution are able to do that, he says. And the best place in Germany to educate oneself about the Constitution is here in Frankfurt, in what's known as the IG Farben building.
Now it is the Goethe University, but before the Goethe University moved in here in 2001, it housed the headquarters of United States Army in Europe.
Nadine Doctor of the Fritz Bauer Institute gives a tour of this building, one that has undergone a few baffling reincarnations. It was originally built for IG Farben, a German pharmaceutical conglomerate that, during World War II, developed Zyklon B, the gas that the Nazis used to kill millions inside its concentration camps. After the war, the U.S. Army based its headquarters here. And in 1948, the heads of the Western German states were gathered here in what was called the Eisenhower Room and ordered to draft a constitution. But when they did, Doctor says the Western German signatories were nervous about what to call this new constitution because of the Soviet occupation of the eastern part of the country.
Because they actually did not want to give up the eastern part of Germany, and they hoped for a reunification, and therefore they did not name it constitution, so they call it Grundgesetz.
Grundgesetz means basic law. The name constitution seemed too permanent at the time. But after reunification in 1990, Germany's government decided to stick with Grundgesetz. It's not known exactly why, but up until then, the document was serving its purpose. And according to at least a few scholars, this American-influenced basic law wasn't broke. So why fix it? Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Frankfurt.
Now we head to China to hear about Fu Zai. Fu Zai is a dog with a local police department there. His breed is unique for that kind of work. He is being billed as China's very first police corgi.
A corgi! My 9-year-old is going to love this story. These short-legged dogs have a reputation for being curious and highly motivated by food. They're also easily distracted. But they have an advantage, according to Fu Zai's police trainer, Zhaoxing Chai, who spoke with Chinese state-run CCTV video news agency about his new trainee. He says corgi's short legs make Fu Zai an ideal candidate for sniffing out explosives in hard-to-reach places, like under vehicles or under train seats. This corgi also has, quote, remarkable interaction skills.
Corgis originated in Wales and are small herding dogs. They do have their critics. Lance Nagosik runs Ultimate Canine Dog Training based in Maryland. He used to train military dogs. He says corgi's small size is a disadvantage.
The bigger a dog's nose is, the more olfactory sensors they're going to have in their nose. A bigger dog like a short hair, a German Shepherd, a Bloodhound is going to have more olfactory sensors, and that's going to make them more capable.
If in the end Fu Zai's police career doesn't work out, he can become a social media influencer because his social media account for him has 400,000 followers. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.